21CL Radio. You're listening to the Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vassar.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to my Run Your Life podcast series. In today's episode, I'm very happy to have my friend Jared Robinson with me today. We're going to talk about a lot of things. A lot of you already know Jared Robinson as the PE geek with the work that he does. Thousands of people know him around the world with the work that he does. I'm really happy to have him on the show. So I'm just going to hand it over to Jared right away to kind of just do a general introduction. Go ahead, Jared.
Hey, Andy, thank you so much for the chance to share with you today. I'm super excited that you've got your podcast out for people, because I reckon this medium is tremendously powerful. And a brief introduction, you know, I'm a phys ed teacher. I grew up being obsessed with sport, and that sort of translated into phys ed teaching. And I teach in a small country school in Victoria, Australia. And somewhere along the line, which I think we'll get into today, I ended up creating a blog and a website around a particular passion that I have for helping phys ed teachers in a particular area. And that led me down this path of helping PE teachers all over the globe.
Yeah, it's been great seeing your work over the last few years, and equally great meeting you in person. So, you know, I knew of you, and then we became connected a few years ago on social media, but it really wasn't until last summer, Artie Kamia's National PE Institute, where we met face-to-face for the first time. And I've said this before, but you were the person that really gave me a kick in the ass, so to speak, with getting my podcast out there. And I guess it took me a long time to kind of define what it was that really struck a chord with me that I wanted to podcast about. So I have a lot of gratitude for you pushing me in that direction. So thank you for that.
Welcome. Like I said, I think this medium really speaks well. And, you know, having seen you speak on numerous occasions online, in person, I think your audience would say the same thing, that your voice is a powerful medium for this stuff. So podcasting for me is you know, it makes sense for you too. And that's why I thought it would be something that you should definitely get into.
Yeah. So it's great to have you on the show. And I think I just want to start off right away. So everybody knows you as the PE geek, Jared Robinson, and the work you do with technology. But what's something that people don't know about you?
They may not know that, you know, I'm sort of a little bit obsessive about the things that I get involved in. And that translates back into these major moments throughout my childhood and my adulthood. And, you know, I was really into video games when I was younger, and, you know, I collected things along that line. I was into hip hop music, and still am, and was really obsessed and knowledgeable about that culture. And I was at the same time really obsessed about sport and track and field. And maybe lots of people don't know that, you know, I represented Victoria, and which is the state in Australia, and presented, you know, ran at the national championships. And it was that actually transpired in many ways into what became today. So yeah, I've always been really focused in on particular things throughout my life, and they've always had a major impact. And one of those is definitely sport.
What was your events? What events did you do in track and field?
So I grew up with, you know, sort of 400, 800 meters as the main focus. And it comes back down to this whole idea of, you know, I got told when I was about 5 or 6 that I was a good runner. And someone, you know, as a young kid, this is pretty motivating. And that absolutely impacted me, and it changed my game. And, you know, I pretty much focused everything around helping myself get better. And that transpired into me being really, really sort of into this. And I had very similar moments with technology as well. In those early days, people used to tell me I was good at it. I was good at, you know, helping people with technology. And it's just funny that they both started in isolation, but eventually have sort of became very interconnected.
So a lot of the stuff I'm reading right now and listening to is Tony Robbins' work, and he, I've talked about him in the last couple podcasts as well, but he describes himself in high school as being the problem solver guy, the person that, that people went to when they had problems, and he just had a natural inclination for helping people solve their problems. Were you kind of the same in terms of tech in high school? Were you really tech savvy and you help people in the area of technology?
Yeah, I would say so. And I mean, it was even in a wider audience than just high school. But it, and it wasn't just technology. I mean, I always felt like I had expertise in various things. And then I would absolutely make that known. People would come to me for that expertise. So, I mean, I mentioned hip hop music. You know, I knew everything about it and collected it and had CDs. So, you know, this was something that people sort of associated with me as being knowledgeable in a particular area. And like one of the areas was technology, though. And, you know, I think back to 1998 when we first got the internet, and I sat down and was already pretty interested in tech, and I sort of taught myself how to do a coding, like build a website, which is really difficult back then because you had to manually do it, like with HTML. And ironically, the thing that I built a website about was athletics and hip hop. These are two things that I really enjoyed, and I built this terrible website about them. But it's just looking at it now, it's just really funny because, you know, it was then when I just decided that building these websites and help, you know, that sort of part of my brain was really rewarding. And here I was over here with sport and music as well, and I combined them into this website that no one ever visited. But it was definitely this idea that you can create these things and people can come to it. And it's looking back now, it seems like it was part of the journey for sure.
And what did you learn from that first experience of coding and building your own website?
To be resilient, like, you know, it was all self-taught. Like, I couldn't go to a teacher and sort of ask them for classes or advice. There wasn't any classes at my school that were teaching me that. It was early days internet, so there was no YouTube. It was pretty laborious to read through stuff and trial, and it all came down to trial and error. Like, everything I did was, will this work? No, it doesn't work. Reset. Do it again. Will this work? Doesn't work. Reset. And I just kept that process over and over and self-taught myself to build this website. And the real defining moment that sort of helped me decide that I wanted to be a teacher is completely related to this. So in year 12, like year 11 and 12, we had an assessment task where we had to do an oral presentation. And part of that, we had to teach something. And all of the people in my class were doing stuff like teaching how to change a bike tire or cook something. And I did something out there for the time, and that was I decided that I would teach people how to code a website. And this is like early 2002. Yeah. And the teacher got together a room full of computers, which was about the only computer room in the school. And this is the first time I ever taught anything. And I taught 30 people in the room to build a website in the 15 minutes. It was nothing spectacular, but the principles of it. And it was then when I realized that, hang on, you know, I really like sport. I really like technology. And I've just taught these people to build a site. And all my friends started saying, you should be a teacher. That was really good. And that's sort of when I decided that I wanted to go down this path.
That's a real sense of empowerment, too, that you found on your own, you know, in your own way.
Completely. And then it was sort of validated by my teacher at the time who said that was really impressive, and you know, I got a really good grade for it, and then friends who were, you know, were in the audience as the people who were learning also said the same thing, and it sort of made them realize what I'd been doing on my own. And to this point, none of my friends were interested in the same thing, and it just sort of became mine then. And I just pursued phys ed teaching. But on the side of that, my second teaching area was information technology. So the exact union of the things that I grew up being sort of really obsessed about.
So so that's what sparked you into your so you did your PE training. What university?
So I did it University of Ballarat, which is in about an hour away from Melbourne, really well-respected university. You have to pick a second method area so that you're more employable. And a lot of people pick maths and geography and English. I chose information technology with about five other people, which is the smallest second method area there was, because I guess, you know, not many people have that shared interest in PE and tech. And we ended up in all the classes of all the people doing like computer sciences, like doing parts of their subject areas. And that's where I learned a lot more, not necessarily things that I use now, but it definitely felt like, you know, a nice place to be. Like I had the main thing, which was my sport and interest in sport, but I had this real side passion in technology and programming and so on that somehow ended up together looking back now.
That's a great marriage. You know, I mean, that's the way you just brought it all together. And if you had to kind of identify actual mentors that you had, one or two mentors you actually had that you knew in person, and mentors that, you know, that you you didn't know, either authors or speakers or whoever it was, who would be mentors, who mentored you?
So one of my early teachers at the time, you know, the exact person who said that I should be a teacher was pretty important to me in those early days, and would, you know, provide me with great feedback and motivation that really sparked me to go down that path. And there was another phys ed teacher who, when I started my training, was changed how they viewed me completely. Like prior to then, I was a little bit, I don't know, maybe difficult student, you might say, and at times, but probably not difficult, probably just really interested in the things I was doing, and anyone who would distract that, I'd probably be a bit difficult around. Yeah. You probably know students like that.
Yeah.
And they changed. They were really helpful in the early days for me. And going on from that, you know, I've learned a lot from, in more recent years, people like Tim Ferriss, which I know that you you're familiar with.
Yeah.
So there's always people behind the scenes, whether it's, you know, in person or whether it's things that I'm consuming. And if you look at it all in reverse, there's a logical sort of progression up that chain of, you know, how this person led to that person and this person led to that person. And I absolutely cannot speak more highly for having someone that you talk to in a mentor capacity.
Yeah. And when you say Tim Ferriss, I mean, a lot, I guess I've found through my consulting and through the work that I'm really passionate about, a lot of it is about the laws of human motivation and the idea of well-being and mindset and all of this. And a lot of that interest and passion has taken me outside the area of PE. And Tim Ferriss is a perfect example. His podcast, I mean, he deconstructs success of people from varying backgrounds and professions. But every single podcast, it doesn't matter if it's a NASA astronaut, some famous, you know, Navy SEALs guy, a musician, there's always amazing takeaway value that I can then pull back to my own teaching in PE. So do you find that as well with kind of mentors outside of PE? There's, when you keep your eyes open and your ears open and your minds open, there's always lessons that you can apply to your own work.
Completely, in every field. So at the moment, you know, I'm really fond of a particular podcast by Dr. Peter Diamandis. And the podcast is Exponential Wisdom. And I mean, he is a person who thinks on a 10x scale, not 10% increment, but, you know, 10x. And his knowledge, you know, I'm not going to be operating at those sort of levels, but just the fact that someone is completely motivating to me. And it sort of, you know, always has me asking the question about what does improvement look like and how could you improve this? And even though it's not in a field that's PE, I apply that same thinking to content I write, to my classes, to everything. So I think you can pick up stuff from all over the place, even if it's in an unrelated field.
Yeah. Peter, I've heard of him. Is he, he's big into artificial intelligence as well, isn't he?
Well, he's massive behind a number of emerging exponential technologies. So He's sort of like the thought leader in those. He works in artificial intelligence. He actually has a company which is trying to increase human longevity and good quality of life, trying to make 120 years of age the new sort of 80.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's involved in lots of fields, and it's really exciting to just hear the landscape of how these things are impacting people. And, you know, whether it's him talking about mining asteroids, like what sort of, that sounds insane.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what they're planning to do. And it's nothing to do with phys ed, but this whole, it just makes me happy to be a human. That's probably where, it, you know, what it comes back to. And we hear so much about negativity in the world. And, you know, when I start seeing these things, I can't help but think the opposite.
Yeah, for sure. And I was listening to a Tim Ferriss podcast with Kevin Costner, and there's one point in particular, and I was never a big Kevin Costner fan, but I had kind of a newfound respect for him, and that he just stuck with, you know, when he had all of his bad movies, he just stuck with it and he stuck with it. And he described a moment when he knew for sure that he had found his love, which was acting, and he was taking night classes in business school, and he saw an advertisement for a theater production, and they were looking for people to try out for different roles. And suddenly something clicked in him, and he's like, that's me. That's what I'm going to do. So he had to drive the next day to this rehearsal, this audition, and he's in his old shitty pickup truck going down the freeway in California, and the brakes go out, and he's going like 80 miles an hour, and he thinks he's going to die. He's literally driving up, and it was when this freeway was being first being constructed, so there were stop signals along the freeway. And then there's a red light, and he's coming up behind a bunch of cars, and he's thinking to himself, I'm going to die here. Like, I'm going to smash into the back end of these cars. He swerves over to the side of the road, slams it into reverse, a standard like stick shift. And then the car comes to a grinding halt just in time. And he's not thinking about that he just survived a near-death accident. He was like, I got to get to this audition. He jumps out of his car, jumps over the barricade, runs to the other side of the road, and hitchhikes to his audition and makes it. And he said that was the moment when he knew that he was passionate about this career change and getting into acting. But what was your kind of defining moment that made you take a leave from teaching and decide to travel the world and consult?
I think if I take a step back a little bit further, and, you know, there was a big defining moment when I first made that decision to go online and start sharing my ideas then. And it was in early 2008. So this is long before people were connecting on Twitter and Facebook and all these other social platforms. I started my blog just pure interest sake and started writing for literally no one. I don't even think my mum came along. Like, to be honest, there was no one really looking at it, but I sort of enjoyed the process of writing. And at some point it, you know, I got a comment from someone about 3 or 4 months into the process. And this is the exact word of the comment. It said, this is the truest and most brilliant thing I've ever read. It was from this person called Tim. And this absolutely changed my mind about how powerful the internet was and how you could share a message. And if you believed in something, then you could get it out to people. And from then I just completely switched my attention to, cause I was pretty close to stopping at that point. You know, I was like, what's the point in this? You know, I don't really see if anyone's even listening, but that changed the game. And then I just continued to do what I do now. And, you know, eventually it got to the point where, you know, there are people listening. There's not just one person who's commented, and it led me down the path of being able to go and tour for 6 months. So I look back at that first comment and think, you know, if that didn't come through, would I have been able to travel for 6 months? Would I have been motivated to continue doing what I was doing? And I don't know the answer, but the funny thing about all of it was 2 or 3 years later, after getting that comment, I revised it and I went back and had a look, and I noticed that it was a spam comment. It wasn't even a real comment on my blog. It was just automated spam comment that fueled me to eventually, you know, be where I am now. And I'm sort of really thankful that it happened.
But it was still, you still started to receive comments on your blog. I mean, when you described that Tim comment, even though it was a spam comment, I think back to my own blog, and the very first person that I ever got a comment from that just blew me away, it was like, holy shit, people are actually reading this. It was from Osama. You know,
it's amazing.
And we all know Osama Abu Jafar from Jordan. He's born in Jordan, but he moved to Dubai and he was working there, and now he's taken on a dean of student role at an IB school in Abu Dhabi, I think. But and it was just receiving that email and knowing that somebody was actually reading that just sparked a whole different level of intrinsic motivation within me. That I know that you experienced the same thing. So
completely.
When did you decide though to take it was going to be a 6-month leave of absence, and that's what we had discussed in Asheville, North Carolina. You were just about to embark on that journey, but when did you actually make that decision?
So this this whole idea of traveling was something that I wanted to do for a long time. Like, there's been all these countries, just me and my partner, you know, heading off and seeing as much of the world as we can. But because of this internet, you know, and the connection that we've made with people and, you know, the help that we've given so far, it presented an opportunity to do work along the way. So we very much, I took 6 months long service leave in Australia. I just got to enough years of service to be able to ask for that amount of time off with some paid and some unpaid portion, which is great. And we decided that we'd fly over to North Carolina and start there and then head on the journey. And it was more about the travel than it was about the work, but it was nice that the two of them could work together. So, you know, I could be in Canada and I could run a workshop for phys ed teachers while I was there. And the only reason that I could do that is because they knew of my website and they'd been there and I had people who listened and followed. And so it's nice when, you know, I'm really passionate about travel and I'm passionate about tech and PE, and put those two together and what happens was that 6-month trip.
Yeah, and I kept up on that trip and watched your your pictures on Facebook, and one of the moments, I was having a shitty day one day and just kind of one of those tough to motivate yourself days. And I saw the video of when you lost your flip-flop in the river, and I laughed my ass off and I felt better. I definitely kept up on your trip and it looked amazing. And so now it has turned into 18 months.
It has. So a bit of a different focus. You know, I took a year leave, and it was sort of we've got so many countries that we still want to visit. Like next month, I'm headed to Africa to do workshops there. And the sort of schools that we're going to be working in, it's just a tremendous opportunity to, impact and give back and meet new teachers and so on. And, you know, I am so passionate about my topic area that any chance I get to talk about it, I'm absolutely going to take it. So this year is all about impact. And, you know, I love teaching and I love being in the class with students, but, you know, this year, it's a chance to create a conference, which, you know, I know that you're speaking at, and also run as many workshops as we can and try and light up as many conversations about this topic area that I'm really passionate about. So I've had to say no to lots in the past when I've been in the classroom, and this year is about saying yes to all of it, focusing in on my health and my well-being and our travel and sort of a different mindset to the previous years. And I've still got teaching in there too. Like I've done some relief teaching and replacement teaching at my own school. So I still get to see the kids that I've, you know, worked with, and it's nice. You know, I get more impact this year than I have previously.
Yeah. I think that as well for me, and you know, what you're describing really speaks volumes with me and resonates, because, you know, I took the year off to consult, and it was just that, to be honest, it was the moment. And, you know, some people know this story, but my wife and I, Neela, were victims of identity theft when we were in Phuket, Thailand a couple summers ago. And we had $27,000 drained from our bank accounts. And it was just that horrifying moment when we were back in Nanjing, and we get paid at the beginning of the school year, you get a big lump sum from your salary, and then they prorate the rest of the yearly salary into a monthly basis. But they give you that big chunk, and we had received that payment, and it was just talking about your heart dropping, you know, using the bank card and seeing balance is zero, and Neela's account the exact same thing. So that, you know, was one of those moments where you just felt completely victimized, and there was nothing that we could do about it. And we had to go through this massive legal process. And I think it was during that time, it was Neela's mindfulness that we were totally putting into practice. Cause I felt there were some days I felt like crying. There were some days I was so incredibly frustrated and angry at the world, thinking we don't deserve this. And it was during that time where we realized money doesn't mean anything. You know, like we were healthy, our boys were healthy, and throughout that legal process, we did get the money back, you know, which was amazing. We never expected it. But it was that point where I was thinking, money doesn't matter. I'm taking the leap and I'm going for it, and I'm just going to follow my passion and consult. And it was the best decision I ever made, you know, such a rewarding experience, you know. So following your journey has reminded me about how much gratitude I have for being able to do what I do as well.
Completely. I mean, if you sort of have a passion and enthusiasm for something, and like, I know you're the same here. If you truly believe that the work that you do in a classroom is beneficial to teachers, then we sort of owe it, I think anyway, to be out there and doing it. And if we can impact more teachers with travel, then I'm going to be prepared to do that. And I can always come back to other roles, and you know, like teaching is always there for me. You know, I'm due back in the classroom in 2017, and it's just nice that we can go out and chase different ideas and follow our passions and give back. So we definitely share that same view.
Yeah. I was speaking with Aaron Hart, and we talked about this pre-show in my podcast with Aaron Hart a few weeks ago. What a great guy he is and what a story he has. But we actually talked about the meaning of work. And, you know, same lines of what we're talking about right here. And Aaron talked about the passion he has for the work he does with U.S. Games and, you know, just everything he's doing with reaching out to those hard-to-reach pockets in the U.S. But, you know, I mentioned you and how the meaning of work might have changed for you based on your experience. So can you elaborate on how the meaning of work and what you do, how that has changed over the past year or couple years for you?
Yeah, I mean, in the early days, it was probably my meaning of work was helping people in my direct line of attention. So that would be students. You know, I'd only really having an impact on a small few regional and local. And, you know, these days I am fortunate enough with the internet and with travel and so forth to have a bigger impact and help people on a global scale, a bigger scale, and a much more diverse scale. So my work has changed like that. My delivery has changed a little bit too. But I still think at the heart of all of it, it's all about the same thing. It's, you know, I was trying to help students bring about the best of their learning and you know, improve. And I'm doing the same thing for teachers. So the core principle is still there, but just sort of the deliveries and who you can get in contact with has sort of changed over time.
Yeah. And what's the greatest resistance that you meet with the work that you do?
Well, I mean, probably it's the same answer everywhere. It's time, money, and willingness to sort of pursue things. You know, teachers are the most time poor people that I can possibly imagine. And part of that comes down to we get given too many things. And the other part of that is that they're pretty terrible at managing tasks. All humans are, to be honest. So yeah. There's that, and sort of managing new things, and that's always a challenge. And then there's the fact that not everywhere is equal, and you know, you can go and work in a school in the Middle East and they're going to be able to introduce and implement the things that you talk about. And whereas you can go to a school in my hometown and they're probably not going to be able to. So it's not a level playing field. I have to vary my message and, you know, what I'm delivering dependent upon who's there and what their hopes are. But for the most part, I think that, you know, people are able to achieve in their constraints. And, you know, I see common themes across the planet in the countries that I work in and the schools I work in. And I would say that, you know, obviously I'm dealing with PE and technology. Regardless of whether there's schools that are operating with really high resources or schools that are operating with really low resources, I haven't seen a common theme that the more resourced you are, the better you'll be able to implement the stuff that we're talking about. So I think the biggest trouble still is good teaching. You know, teachers, that needs to be at the heart of it. And, you know, you can have a really well-off school with lots of resources and money for days, and you can have a bad teacher that teaches that school. You know, you're going to give them a device and they're still going to be a bad teacher. So there's no connection. And I think that's still the biggest difficulty, is making sure that people wrap good teaching around it.
Yeah, I think that, and I've said this before in the workshops that I've run, is I have worked with schools that have every resource imaginable. And the teachers, to be honest, are, it's not that they don't want to be good, but they just have a hard time thinking outside of the box. Whereas I've worked with schools that have very limited resources, and then these teachers that I've worked with are incredibly resourceful and innovative, and they're forced to think outside of the box and make things happen. You know, so you're right that the success at which people implement new ideas is not dependent upon the resources that they have, but their resourcefulness.
Completely agree. And this, something about like limitations and deadlines that pressure cooks results. You know, I heard the other day that someone said the show MasterChef, there's like a challenge that's time-based. And out of all of the MasterChef shows across the planet, there's only ever been one person that's not delivered a meal. You know, obviously they're all to different qualities of taste, but only one person who's physically missed delivering a meal. And I think it's because of the deadline. Like, there's a deadline there, they get it done. And I think in schools that have low resources, you know, they're different constraints, but we work within them and we get quite innovative because of that.
Have you seen the show Cutthroat Kitchen?
No.
Okay, so... yeah, I'm just bringing this up because it connects to what you're saying with time constraints and MasterChef. But it's one I love cooking, right? And it's my boys Eli and Ty turned me on to it. So essentially, it's like MasterChef. So you got four chefs at the beginning that are having cook-offs. But what happens is each cook has $25,000 that they can use throughout the challenge. You know, the different challenges that they're faced with. So the host of the show will bring in different things. So, for example, a figure skate. So now you and I can bid on that figure skate, because what's going to happen is if I bid higher than you and I win the figure skate, then I can give the figure skate to one of the other chefs and take their knives away. They have to use the figure skate to cut, to chop up everything and make their meal. Amazing innovation, right? So the whole show is based around creating these challenges that you have to overcome and still prepare the meal on time. And it's fascinating, you know, to see how...
Clearly, I say that transcribes into so many different areas, like constraints force thinking to take place. Like, all the biggest problems at the moment in the world are in a position now to be solved by someone in their garage at home. And, you know, the person in their garage at home doesn't have as much resources, can't think as, you know, bigger scale as governments. But a lot of our problem solving is coming from those smaller places, not the big governments with unlimited resources and unlimited, you know, stuff at their disposal and laws and so on. It's really happening down in the other end, which I find is fascinating.
That's what, you know, Seth Godin?
Yeah,
that's all him. That's what he talks about, you know, and the garage and the basement and these companies with, instead of having 100 with only 3, and they're the company with 3 is accomplishing what the company of 100 accomplishes, because they are taking it to a new level and solving problems and getting their work out there, even though they don't think it's ready, you know. So
completely.
Yeah. So What is your, and I asked this to, I did a podcast with Mike Cazala the other day. He's the author of The Kinesthetic Classroom, and he's a keynote speaker at the IRCOS conference coming up in Manila. But I asked him what he felt his biggest concern about the physical education profession is, his biggest worry. If you, and you might not even have one, but do you have any kind of concern or worry about where our profession is going, or whether it's stuck or whatever? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm generally more optimistic about how things are progressing. So, you know, I do see waves of teachers that care less and so on. But, you know, I try and think more positively than the fact that there may be doom and gloom and not everything's perfect. But, you know, what I tend to see is there are people throughout the planet who are pushing to try and make things better. And, you know, that is what motivates me to make that call. But in saying that, there's, you know, I still think that, you know, the biggest problem that we have is that good teaching doesn't scale. And that might be a really big statement to make, but I'll explain it. Good teaching doesn't scale because we're primarily talking about, you know, 1 billion people, you know, over that, who have traditional classroom environments and teachers who go through programs and professional development. But we tend to ignore the fact that there's still about 4 billion people who don't have any of that. So, I mean, they haven't got classrooms, they don't have good teaching training and so forth. So that's what my concern is about, that, you know, how do we reach those people when you can't even get into, say, Syria because it's too dangerous? You know, that's why good teaching doesn't scale. It's got to be sort of a different approach. So that's something that I think about a lot.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so true. There's, you know, like, and that's what Aaron Hart said. I mean, the work Aaron does is reaching the 85% of teachers who don't have access to it. You know, so he feels so rewarded when he can reach those hard to reach pockets. And that's what really gives him that personal satisfaction with the work that he does professionally. And the concern, and I'm like you, is that I'm very optimistic and positive, and I believe in the goodness of people, you know. And I've seen a little bit of a trend on Twitter that is sometimes the idea that a teacher will put some activities up there and then other teachers will copy the idea and apply it in their own classes, which is great. But I will oftentimes get emails from teachers saying, oh, can you send me those assessments? I'm more than happy to share my work and send assessments, but a lot of times those assessments will not apply to another teacher's classroom and their teaching environment because I've created them based on the student learning in my program, relationships I've formed. I know my students. So it's that idea that it takes a lot of work to refine how we deliver assessment. And I think of Joey Fite and the work he does. And you know, Joe, there's so much hard work behind the scenes, you know. And people look at Joey or at your work and they'll see what you're doing around the world and think, oh, my God, like that just – I can never be like that. They've got something special. But the reality is, behind the scenes, you guys have put a massive amount of work into what you do.
Completely, yeah. I'm the first to admit it. So I mentioned that this year's very much about getting back to health, and that's a core focus of mine at the moment. So, you know, I've put that first ahead of everything, and I've got a bit of time to do that this year in between travel and so on. And because, you know, the people didn't see the amount of, you know, I'm saying 4 years, three or four years of no holidays. So I, you know, school holiday periods, I didn't take them. I would hop on a plane and go overseas. And it wasn't work to me because I was really passionate about what I was doing, like loved it. And weekends, you know, I'd often run workshops on weekends or fly overseas on weekends. And then in and amongst that, I had to author this content, which would have me working more than 100-hour weeks. So people don't see that behind the scenes. But fortunately, you know, in the last couple of years, I've got a bit smarter about focusing in on the things that I do best and delegating the rest, or just completely not doing the rest. Because if you look at our lives, there will be 20% of the things that you do that bring about 80% of your results. And we too often add in too many things that don't really move the needle. And I had so many of those, so I've got rid of them.
And then it just gives you a more specific direction and purpose.
Completely. So, I mean, you can factorize that down even further, and my maths isn't great here, but it's if 20, this is, you may not know of the theory that this comes from, but the 80-20 principle is observed throughout both nature and also through.
Okay, just continue.
So you may not know this, but this 80-20 principle is observable in nature and in economics and all these other facets. And it's this idea that 20% of what you do brings about 80% of the results. And you can look, it's observable in nature too. It's tremendous when you start to observe this. And if you factorize that down even further, 6% of the things that you do bring about 64% of your results. I mention it because not everything's equal, and we tend to do so many things that don't really move the teaching forward in our class. We tend to take on things that don't really give back as much as we might put out. So I've had to rebalance a lot, and I would absolutely imagine that people listening, there's things in their lives that you could get rid of that would not impact on your results, whatever those results may be that you're looking for.
Yeah, and I think that goes with the idea of, like, if you bring on something new, then what are you willing to get rid of? That it may be working, but it might not be working, but you've got to remove something from your plate when you bring on something new. And I guess it goes back to redefining your purpose and how purpose your purpose will shift over time, and you just continually redefine that. We've got a couple more minutes here. I would like to just take it in the direction just to kind of close off, but what do you think, what's the greatest lesson that you want to share with teachers, if you had to just kind of define a big lesson in your life? And it doesn't have to be something that you just learned. It could be something from 20 years ago, but what's something that you think that teachers could really benefit from knowing?
I don't believe that there's anything that's perfect. So, you know, this whole idea that perfection is something that we're trying to attain, don't believe it. I think it's more about the process of what actually, you know, what we do, whether that's learning some new skills or new knowledge, whatever. I don't think we actually reach a destination as such. It's more about the process. And I know you think very similar to me in that regard.
Yeah, definitely. It's for me, it's when I took the focus away from being product oriented, my life definitely took on new meaning, you know, because, you know, it's so easy to judge ourselves based on what we produce and the products of our hard work. But in the end, I want to be defined more by the hard work I put into the process of becoming a better person and a better learner and all of that. So I know that you know, like you said, that's what you believe in as well. Could you tell people, as we close off the last couple of minutes, specifically about Connected PE?
So, you know, I've been pretty fortunate to see phys ed on this global landscape. You know, I've worked in 32 countries with teachers. I've built up lots of networks. I've seen lots of common issues and achievements. And Connected PE is like the amalgamation of all of that. So it's an opportunity to host a conference in an area which is underserved in the Middle East and bring in the world's leading phys ed specialists and experts to run keynotes and training related to physical education. So I'm really excited about it, and it changes how conferences run. Conferences typically are about 2 days where you meet up and you learn as much as you can, whereas we're more about the stuff that happens in the lead up and the follow up than just the 2 days. So I'm super excited. It's changing the model of conferences a little bit, and it's broadening not to be all about phys ed and not just about phys ed technology. And I'm really excited that you're part of
it. I'm really looking forward to that one. I like what you're doing on both the front and back ends of the conference. And it's that lead up support and that lead up connection, as well as that follow up connection, because that is what conferences traditionally, you know, that's where the flame kind of burns out after, you know, there's that lead up, but then after, boom, you know, you got to really be motivated to continue that, to keep your flames lit, you know, but you have both that front end lead up and support as well as that follow up, which makes it very unique. Yeah.
Completely. And I'm realistic in that not everyone is going to sort of pursue the lead up activities and the follow up activities. That's fine. But for those that do, I'm pretty hopeful because I've seen it in my own workshops that the follow up stuff and the lead up stuff can be really helpful. You know, just by creating the conversation over a longer period of time, because that's where learning takes place. I mean, I'm just mirroring what we do in the classroom, really. Like, we don't just come in for 2 days and give the kids everything we can imagine and then they disappear. It's more sustained. So that's what sort of prompted the model.
Yeah, I really look forward to it. And so that's going to be October, is it 7th and 8th?
7th and 8th, yeah.
Yeah, so I'll have all that information in the show notes now. I'm going to put you in the hot seat to close off the podcast. I'm actually going to what I will have guests do as they finish the podcast is to share a lesson, but you've already done that. So I'm going to steal a page from Tim Ferriss's podcast when he asks his guests what books they would gift somebody. So what would be your, say, either top book or top three books that you would recommend or give somebody for their birthday or Christmas? So your favorite books.
Well, the 4-Hour Work Week was pretty defining to me. So it's a Tim Ferriss book, and it's not about just working 4 hours. It's a bit of a misleading title, but it's an insight into this the way that society is moving with global connectedness and so on. So big fan of that. I also like Essentialism, which is by Greg, can't remember the last name, but it's, again, it's about focusing in on the things that we do best and not necessarily trying to overload ourselves with too much. So it's a common issue. We do too much. We really do. And yeah. I think people can, it's a really disciplined pursuit to try and do less, and the book will help with that.
Do you have any more?
0 to 1. 0 to 1. By Peter Thiel is sort of an insight into how businesses grow, and it's not more than business though. It's more about life, and again, focusing in on the things that we do best and ignoring the rest, because that's been a big challenge for me. You know, I used to say yes to everything and do everything. And when you realize that you cannot be the master of everything, and you are sort of determined in one area, then you can have big results. And, you know, I think this is applicable to more than just me.
Yeah, it sounds great. So the 4-Hour Work Week, Essentialism. So I'll look up the author, Greg, and then 0 to 1 by Peter. Did you say Peter Thiel?
Yes.
Okay. So, oh, that's great. And that's a good way to close off the show. So, Jared, thanks for taking the time to be on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
More than welcome. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. And I hope you keep coming back and listening to future episodes.
Thanks for listening to the Run Your Life podcast by Andy Bassett. To check out show notes, get some more information about Andy as well as his guests, head to our website, 21clradio.com.